and welcome to Season 3, Episode 9 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee with Drs. Justin Winzenberg and Stephen Jones. In this podcast, we look to explore truth, beauty, wisdom, and goodness at the intersection of faith and scholarship. Today, we jump back into a conversation about Justin's dissertation. In this series, we consider his research methods, which I found really interesting. Today, we talk about speech act theory as it relates to interpreting biblical texts. But first, here are our highlights, lowlights, and insights for the week. So you drinking any coffee today?
I am. I'm drinking some coffee from home. And in fact, it was sent to me by a good friend all the way from Europe.
Oh,
that was you. Yeah, man, I've been enjoying these beans. So for our listeners, you generously sent home a couple of bags of beans with a friend, and he hand delivered it to my office, and we've been enjoying those beans. They were wonderful, and I'm drinking some this morning. So
nice. Have you gotten into both bags?
Yep. Well, in fact, the first one's gone. So okay. Yeah, it won't last long.
Which one do you like better?
I can't say I like one better than the other. I think I like them both equally.
Nice.
And the problem is I didn't drink them. I mean, I drank the whole bag. I mean, my wife and I drank the whole bag of one and then moved on to the other. So I wasn't able to pair them side by side.
You weren't doing testing.
No, I should have. I really should have. That's but it's wonderful. Where did you find that coffee?
It's one of the main suppliers here in Germany.
Nice.
And so actually there's store down on the main street not far from us. So yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
What about you? What are you drinking today?
I have been drinking a lot of coffee today.
You haven't got much sleep, huh?
I haven't gotten much sleep the last couple of days. We have somebody in our house who has COVID, and so we've had to rearrange the sleeping arrangements, to provide for isolation, and I have ended up in a place that I'm not sleeping well. And so that, and I also started a new level of an intensive language course this morning. And so
we did.
Between those two things, I'm a little bit shot. So, but I will tell you, my first cup of coffee today was a little espresso. We bought from one of our colleagues here, an Nespresso, where it does the little, it whirls it around and, which I had one of those at the International Lounge at the college.
Still there.
Nice. And,
I still use it every now and then.
Nice. Yeah, as you should. And I had forgotten how much better it was. We had a pod coffee maker here that we used occasionally. Usually we just do French press, but I did an espresso this morning with that Nespresso, and it was very nice. It was a good way to start the day. So yeah, think my Fitbit says I got 4 hours of sleep. So needing something to get going. But yeah. What's a highlight for you this week?
Well, I think I have two highlights. One is that I scored the biggest score ever on Amazon. There was this book. It's called Reading Romans Through Roman Eyes.
Okay.
It's the book I wanted to write that someone else beat me to.
Uh-huh.
It's pretty new, but it's $140, and I couldn't spend $140 on that book. But it's really relevant.
It is crazy how expensive academic books are. It's like,
well, I've got to be careful because I just recently saw that my book, which is supposed to come out in May here, is listed on Amazon for $119. So,
you're definitely undercutting this other one. So,
so I do understand it. It's unfortunate though, because this book, I think, if it were cheaper, I would require it for one of my classes.
I know that.
I just wanted to get my hands on one myself just so I could give it a more thorough reading. And I just kept looking at Amazon every now and then. Well, all of a sudden, brand new, it pops up for $5.50.
What?
So I purchased two of them. Like, I got to get two. Well, they send me one. And I'm like, well, where's the other one? Oh, I'm sorry. We messed the order up. So they refunded me the whole amount. I got that book for free.
What?
$140, man. It was the best score ever.
So you ended up only with one copy, but you didn't pay anything for it?
Correct. Yeah.
Wow.
There's something about a good win when with books. It's just very exciting.
It is. Yeah. It is. Yep. And then we had an academic showcase here at the workplace where students from all sorts of other disciplines or various disciplines present projects they've been working on. And then,
oh, nice. Is this new?
Yeah. Yep. It's brand new. And I think it comes with some prizes. So nice. Students are encouraged to do this. And I was really impressed with the presentations and with the projects in general. So that was quite a bit of fun.
And you said it was from across the disciplines?
Yeah. Yep. So we had science presentations. We had some ministry and theology presentations. We had education. We had a law history combo. So it was, yeah, nice. It's very good.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
What's been a highlight for you?
I mean, there's several, but one of them is that we went to Paris this last week to celebrate my daughter's 16th birthday. And that was just really nice. We took the train there, which is about 8 to 10 hours. And it's a long ways, but it was just, I don't know, a very easy trip. And then, yeah, we had a full day in Paris, two nights, and it was just nice. It was very pleasant, sunny. And although I have to say, I've been in Paris probably, I don't know, 8 times or so, and it was the busiest I've ever seen Paris. So I don't know.
Really?
Yeah, it could be, it was Easter break here. And so that may be part of why, like, I think in a lot of Europe, it was Easter break. Also, it seems like maybe people are trying to make up from all the COVID restrictions. So yeah, it was a little bit intense, like how many people were there, but it was a lot of, I don't know, it was really fun. Yeah. And a nice way, you know. My daughter can't work on her driver's license or anything here. That's not a thing. And so this was a nice different thing to do for her to mark, you know, what feels like a pretty major birthday. So
that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I forget how that 8-hour train trip is equivalent to me going to Kansas City.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And now did you take an overnight train or anything?
No, we talked about it. Okay. We were just in a normal Intercity Express and it's, just fast. Like, at one point we were going 320 kilometers an hour, which is 200 miles an hour. It's, you know, just fun.
That's great. Yeah. We're looking forward. We're taking a train, you know, up from Prague to Berlin to see you guys. And the kids have never been on a train before. So that'll be fun for them, I think.
I have to say, I got a great coffee on the train, which was surprising.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. It was big too, which is unusual. So that was nice.
Was it Deutsche Bahn or was it a different? Oh, that's what we're taking. So nice. I'm hoping they serve the same coffee.
Make your way down to the restaurant car and see if I'm lying. Exactly.
Well, do you have a low light from this past week?
So in Paris, I my formal French study is 3 hours on like 3 clock hours is I was passing through Paris once and had an opportunity to take a class for literally 3 hours. And that was, all of the French study I ever did. But I was in Mali quite a bit and I went through Paris, like I said, quite a bit. And I had picked up a lot of kind of survival French and I could get around and function relatively well. And in Mali, I would listen to sermons in French and I would understand quite a bit of it. And I found that it had been 8 years since I was last in Paris. I had been in France, just across the border once in 2019 for like 3 hours. Basically have not really been in France, for 8 years, and I was shocked how little I was able to access my French, and it was super discouraging because I was like, "Well, I really liked, you know, having some French." And part of it, as somebody has shared with me the illustration of like when you have multiple languages, that it's kind of like all of them go to the same attic space, and so then the ones that you're working with more currently you know, are at the closer part of the attic, and the old languages are still there, but you got to go digging through to find them. And that's exactly how I felt. And I was able to understand a, you know, a reasonably good amount of the interaction, but I don't know. That was, it was sad. I was just like, oh, I used to know what to say. Like when I would walk in and, you know, want to order something in a, which of course is most of what I was doing, is ordering food, you know, cause we're on this little mini vacation. And, anyway, I think the other piece of that is I'm, you know, worrying about, you know, how much of my Spanish has gone away, or is maybe not hasn't, you know, maybe hasn't gone away, but it's similarly hidden. You know, it's
laying dormant at the moment.
Yeah. Well, a couple of times recently I've tried to make a Spanish sentence, like just, you know, practicing speaking or talking with my kids who are taking Spanish in school right now. And, I'll get halfway through a sentence and then I'll realize I've switched to German, which is good from the German learning perspective, but, you know, is a little bit, discouraging, you know, in terms of, oh, I hope I still have access to that other language, but how about for you? What's a low light been?
Oh, well, we've, you know, we're at an interesting transitional time of the year in academics where you, this is the time you find out who's not coming back for the fall,
in terms which happens of every year. Students or in terms of colleagues?
No, that's pretty clear, right? The students who will be graduating or students, I guess, who decide not to come back. But no, I'm thinking more of employees.
Okay.
Because you start to get your departure notifications from some who decided to go onto different jobs or to, you know, whatever. And so, you know, the loss of a few colleagues from this institution going elsewhere is always a little bit sad. Mm-hmm. And so we've got some people who, you know, are just important contributors of what we're doing at work that won't be with us here in the fall. And that's always just a sobering thing. And then the task of trying to fill their roles and find replacements, you know, that's, you've been through that because we lost you a couple of years ago in terms of you departing from us, in terms of the workplace, that's such a normal thing for most people in their workplaces, but just because of the calendar that we do, I think it just like, there's a certain time of year where it happens.
Yeah.
Unlike maybe other jobs where it can happen any point during the year.
Yeah, that is true. There are a couple of hiring and departure cycles in the academic. Yep. Yeah. You know, I don't think I ever got, are they doing cake for any of these people?
And I don't think you ever got cake because of COVID. Well, there was two things, I think, and that, and then your transition from full-time to adjunct.
Right.
We just, unfortunately, we don't normally, you know, it's sad, this is the truth, but we don't normally, if adjuncts depart from us, we don't normally have cake for them.
It's like I didn't count anymore when I left as an adjunct because I did that 1 year as an adjunct after. And then the year that it would have counted was everything. We weren't on campus because of COVID.
It was for sure because of COVID though. Because had we been there, we would have given you a departing cake.
Thanks.
Moment.
Thank you.
Party.
No, it was a super awkward, I remember we were on a call. Yeah. We were having a faculty meeting remotely.
That's right. I do remember that.
It's like, just the sound of that is very painful. But we were having this remote faculty meeting and then I think I had my 15 seconds to say something. Yep. And then I think that's not the best way to do it.
Anyway, yeah.
You have an insight this week?
I don't know if I have a specific insight, but I'm thinking about something now because of a conversation you and I were having prior to us starting our recording today. So maybe I'll let you start with your insight and we could play off it. But you and I were having just a brief conversation about the American church and sort of the exposure or lack thereof that you're getting over in Europe. In other words, that you said something about seeming, Elliot, maybe I'll just let you say what you were sure, saying, and then we can converse about it some.
I think, I mean, so I've been gone long enough. It's 9 months now that we've been living here. And I am realizing that I need to be careful about so this is my insight right for the week, that I need to be careful about assuming that I know how things are in the church in the US. Mm. Because I remember how they were when I left, or at least, you know, my perception of how they were when I left. And then what, you know, there's always the risk of kind of pursuing things that have that confirmation bias. And I think that that combined with the fact that my media diet has changed and that who I have access to.
I've never heard that phrase, media diet. Wow.
Is that a thing? I don't know if that's a thing.
maybe. I like it though.
Some of the things that do make it through here mm-hmm. are particularly negative, right? Like the things that actually cross my radar, so to speak, like are not great. And I think one of the things that you were mentioning was just this excitement in one of your New Testament classes and how the students are engaging that. And I think, there are a couple other things that you've mentioned. Anyway, I think there's this sense in which sometimes I'm coming across maybe things that don't feed the confirmation bias, things that push against and say like, no, there's good stuff and don't be overly simplistic. And of course it would be possible to be overly simplistic the other way too and say like, oh, things are great in the American church. So I don't know. It's a little bit of a messy insight, but I think the recognition of physical distance, but also distance in time. And then, just the recognition that I need to be careful about assuming that what I knew to be true, number one, was as true as I thought it was. And number two is still true.
And it's always, to me, I wonder, because when when following stuff on social media, it's like, are we in kind of a Yelp situation where you're either going to hear the incredible stories or you're going to hear the complete criticisms, and what's actually happening on ground level is probably just more plain than that most of the time.
And there's two reasons for that, right? Like, because it could be what people are posting, number one, but then also what the algorithm picks.
Oh, bingo. Yeah. And that's something I wonder about, because I feel like I can definitely see where institutionally and maybe within individual church communities and individual Christians can fit on a certain spectrum of very terrible things are happening to like, oh, delightful things are happening. Mm-hmm. But it's like most of the Christian people that I'm encountering are not probably fitting on either end of the spectrum of the heroic Christians who are, who are doing such magnificent things that everything needs to be posted, or they're doing such horrific things and being such terrible Christians and people that it should be posted about. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I feel like I'm not trying to dismiss those stories that emerge from American Christianity that are very negative, and rightly so. They're true stories, but whether that's the entirety of what a lot of people are encountering is a different situation. And those things deserve to be called out and deserve to be exposed. But that's the stuff that's generating chatter.
Yeah. But I think at the same time, what's
not generating chatter are people who go to churches that are living faithful lives, but but nothing is newsworthy.
Yeah. Or even like that you're having great conversations in a New Testament class. Like,
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose you could post that on Twitter, but I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to get a lot of traction.
No, I don't think so either.
Hey guys, just had a great conversation in New Testament. Like, okay.
Yeah. Hope that we don't feel like we're getting too thick in here and this will be understandable to people, but
I mean, I think it is at least bringing it more into, I feel like what we're doing is like reaching into the closet where you have all the tools and you're like, okay, you've probably not seen this one before, but let me take it out and explain it to you and show you how it works.
Yeah. And even if not everyone understands the jot and tittle of how this stuff is applicable to the conversation I'm having with Ephesians, I hope what it does is it gets people to go, this is interesting, in terms of them asking, well, what have I assumed about what is important for reading the Bible?
Right.
And that I think is what was a bigger meta question that's lingering over this whole conversation that doesn't really have to relate to the details of my particular work.
Yeah, that makes sense.
There's another portion of the conversation available for free on Patreon, in which we talk about implied versus empirical audience and context. It's a super interesting conversation and bridges between the previous episode and this one. Find that conversation and more at patreon.com/profsinrooms. We'll be back in a moment with the conversation about speech act theory. So we last time talked, the last couple of times we were talking about implied and empirical authorship, implied and empirical audiences, implied and empirical context, just a little bit. But then you are using, there's this other tool that you use in the hermeneutic that you propose for looking at the question of, is Ephesians engaged in a critique of the empire? And this second tool that you use is speech act theory, which I think is fascinating. I learned about it from you and then used it in my dissertation too.
Yeah.
Although you definitely know it more than I do. So I enjoyed reading this section in your dissertation. But can you give us just a quick overview of what is speech act theory?
Yeah. Speech act theory asks not just what words mean, but how they're used. That's basically it. There was a guy named Austin who was a scholar over in the UK, and he gave this lecture in the 1950s at Harvard, and he basically said, like, everyone's been disputing about meanings of words and about the sort of static nature of what words might mean, and no one's been paying attention to how they're used or what they're trying to do. So his lecture is titled "How to Do Things with Words." Mm. That's it, and that I think can that encapsulates speech act theory pretty well, is that speech act theory says, okay, communication isn't just about word meaning, it's about the use of words and what words are trying to do to people.
Do to people. That's an interesting way to put that. Do to
people.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the classic example, and Austin uses this, I didn't invent this, but I invoke it. And I apologize if there are any past students listening who have heard me say this many times, but it's a simple sentence that can easily point out why speech act theory is necessary. And it's a sentence, "The ice is thin over there." Mm-hmm. If we were to approach this from just the nature of, well, what do the words mean? And that the word meaning will help us reveal what the sentence means, it's going to provide some limitations. The ice is thin over there. None of those English words are all that disputed in their meaning. Mm-hmm. But the important thing would be to say, yeah, but what were those words intending to do in the sentence? Mm. And almost always, because of our Midwestern Northern context, it's funny that a lot of people would maybe assume that the ice is thin over there is intended to warn someone from walking on the ice.
A literal situation of the ice, like on the lake or on the river, is thin over there. Be careful.
Be careful. So the word meaning is really in undisputed for the most part in the sentence, you know, the ice, right? And you could do all this word mm-hmm. studies, but no, at the end of the day, they're pretty simple words. The question though is what are they trying to mean? And it can mean, be careful. It can be a warning. But the problem is that the context matters.
But the words, be careful, don't appear in that sentence,
no,
right?
No. So this would be more explicit in its meaning if it said, be careful, the ice is thin over there.
Mm-hmm. But even then, it wouldn't necessarily have to be literal, right?
No. In fact, I bring this up in my dissertation. Even then, and this would be a little bit awkward wording, but be careful, the ice is thin over there could mean don't walk on that ice as a warning, or it could mean I would watch what you're saying mm-hmm. around that person.
Which means you could be in the deep south, right? In the middle of summer where there's no ice around and you could say it and it could still have meaning.
Yeah, because the ice is thin over there could be invoking the phrase like you're on thin ice. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Which isn't a response to actual water and ice. It's talking about a social situation where, you're walking on eggshells, you're on thin ice, you know, like, oop, be careful what you say.
You could say it in Minnesota in the middle of winter on a frozen lake and still not be talking about the physical ice. You can mean the exact same thing that you mean in this, you know, in the other situation where you're saying, hey, be careful. Be aware that there is social danger and you're getting close to it.
Yep. Or, and this is even better because of the Minnesota context. You know, I have a friend who, when we were in college together, he was from Jamaica and he heard that we walk on ice in the wintertime. And so he said to my buddy, like, wait a second, you walk on the ice?
And my friend said, no, we drive on it. You know, and the funny thing was, right, is I mean, he's coming from a context where like the walking on the ice, that's a fearful thing. But here's the funny thing about the Minnesota context is that saying the ice is thin over there might not actually be a warning at all. It might actually be a directive.
Yeah.
You might be saying to the person, why don't you go with your ice auger since you're going ice fishing and drill over there instead of over here.
So instead of a warning, it could be saying, oh, hey, keep going, go further. The ice is thin over there.
Now, if everyone were explicit in their exact meaning every time, none of this would be necessary. Speech-check theory wouldn't be as necessary, because if it were to say, let me direct you, friend, to where the ice is thin so that you may use your auger to, you know, if someone said that, then this speech-check theory approach wouldn't be as necessary. Mm-hmm. But that's not how language often works. We have all sorts of assumed contexts. We use simple words sometimes to convey very different meanings in very different situations. And if all we look at is word meaning, we'll misunderstand the meaning.
Man, that's so true. Like we've been learning about the different things that we need to learn to be able to say that we actually know German. And the formal linguistic competence is only one of the four competencies that we need to know. We also need to know sociolinguistic competence. We have to develop our discourse competence. We have to develop strategic competence, right? Like there's these different ways of engaging language that are so much further, so much bigger than just the mere question of what are the words themselves saying.
Yeah. Yeah. And let me talk about why this is relevant for my project, because it's extremely important. So far, a lot of the conversations in imperial critical readings of the New Testament, there have been these huge critics who come along and said, I don't see the empire anywhere in the text. Paul doesn't mention the empire. Paul doesn't critique the empire. And if he were to, he would do it in this or that way. The problem is that's often coming at an approach, a very narrow approach that suggests if Paul were to critique the empire, he would say, I hereby critique the empire. It would have to be explicit communication. It would have to use a certain combination of words and grammar. When what I'm saying is actually, you don't have to say anything about the empire explicitly to critique it. Because it can critique it on the level of on a higher level, on a different level of communication than just word meaning.
I mean, don't you think? I'm just thinking about comedians or like late night talk show hosts, right? They do this kind of stuff all the time, where they're implicitly critiquing things without saying them.
And not just comedians; everyone does it. Like, think about this. So, what if I made the statement? You know that Americans should be careful how they act in the world. That's a generic statement. Mm-hmm. It might not mean anything other than it could, I mean, it might mean we look silly to others. And so we need to be conscious of how we, you know, convey ourselves to other people in the world. It might mean that if we do certain things in other cultures that are acceptable in the US, that it could put us in harm's way. But one interesting possibility is it might have the subtext of Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. So then what I might be actually doing is I might be critiquing the Biden administration's pull from Afghanistan. No, if you did a dictionary word study on any of the things I said, is that going to resolve it? It won't. No. And so you need a lot more in order to understand what words are doing. Mm-hmm.
Right. And that same phrase in 1940 would have a completely different meaning, even though the words and the sentences themselves would mean the same thing.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. And so what I think, since a big question I'm asking is if someone were to try to subvert or challenge an ideology, how would they go about doing it? There's been a lot of New Testament scholars who will have assumed the way they would do it is they would be explicit. Now, others have responded by saying, no, they wouldn't be explicit because there's danger out there if they did.
And this has to do with the context question.
Yep. No, they might be persecuted if they do. So they're quiet about it. And then the other people reply with, no, you're overplaying the persecution element. That wasn't that dangerous. And so I engage this conversation in much different ways by number one saying, well, first off, if anyone wants to challenge the empire, they don't have to name the empire one bit. It happens all the time. What they might do is they might invoke ideas held by the empire and throw it on someone else.
Yeah.
You know, in a way that I conceive of this is, and this is a little bit of an old example for some of our listeners, but there was a time when the presidency of the US was highly contended because of these ballots in South Florida. Mm-hmm. This is the Bush election of what would it
Bush
have been?
Gore, the 2000, yeah. Dingling Chads.
Yep. And so if I ran into Al Gore, you know, 2 months after that thing was resolved, and I saw him in the park and I said, "Hey, Mr. President," you know, that could mean a lot of things. Mm-hmm. It could mean that he is a president of a corporation. And all I'm saying is that, hey, I understand that you run this company. It could be that I'm actually taking a jab at him. Mm-hmm. "Hey, Mr. President, you loser. You didn't actually win." Or I could be subverting the Bush presidency.
Right.
I could be saying, "You're the president, not Bush. You deserve it. You want it. Fair and square." It's a simple phrase, but the context matters. And in fact, if I wanted to subvert the Bush presidency, I could use a very simple sentence and phrase to do it. Mm-hmm. Without even, by the way, saying George Bush isn't president. You know, without
naming George Bush at all, without naming the ballot controversy, without naming any of that.
Yes, yes. And so there's been all this dispute in New Testament studies, whether when titles that were used of the emperor are given to Jesus, whether these would have been understood as a slight to Roman imperial power. Ah,
so this is where it connects then, right?
This is where it starts to connect. And then there's all these disputes and some will say, no, the language doesn't mean that. And what I am interested in is less, could this word mean this or that? I'm interested in when the word is used in a certain context, invoking a certain environment. What's the author doing? That's it.
That's super interesting.
So if Austin's question was how to do things with words, my question is how to subvert with words.
So,
and sometimes you don't use any words that are explicit to do it.
Yeah. And I'm thinking like probably most of us have been in institutional contexts, whether that's in school or in work or whatever, where we have done exactly that. Usually regarding the leadership or some colleague or whatever. Yeah. And we have basically insulted that person in a way that's not traceable to the words that were actually said.
Yeah. And sometimes it's because we would be afraid of losing our job, but sometimes it's not that at all.
Or sometimes it'd be because you want to communicate frustration, but you don't want to break the relationship. Right.
Bingo. Yeah. That's where it's complicated. And I think those scholars who are saying, well, was there a persecution context? I do engage that question, but that's such a limited question that it's kind of irrelevant in some ways. Because even if there isn't a threat of persecution, there may be strategies as to why somebody wouldn't explicitly subvert that aren't related to fear. Mm-hmm. So what I say is some will say, hey, when Paul was writing, there was no danger. If he wanted to subvert Rome, if he wanted to challenge their ideology, he would have just came out and said it. And what I say actually is what speech act theory demonstrates is that sometimes it's actually more effective to subvert implicitly than explicitly. It has nothing to do with danger. Mm.
Certainly, if danger is present, it makes even more sense to do that. And that's where you get into later in your dissertation talking about the timing of Ephesians affects that question, right? Which has to do with the context. It does. But the core point that you're making here is just that words may be doing something that a strict grammatical reading won't give us access to. And this, I think once you think about it for very long, it's super obvious. But I think when you first come across it, it can be a little unsettling.
Well, and it's not part of our normal hermeneutic in New Testament studies in many ways. And here's an interesting example. And I actually use this in my book, but there's been this huge dispute in Ephesians 5 regarding the word that we translate as head.
Oh, interesting.
It says the husband is head of the wife, as like Christ is the head of the church.
Yeah.
And there's been articles and articles written on, is head like an authoritative figure? Or is it the source? Like there's all these disputes on what head means. Mm-hmm. And what's so funny is, in fact, I just saw this on Twitter. There are these complementarians who are people who generally think that men and women have different roles designed by God and that mm-hmm. women are not afforded the same leadership roles in the household or in the church community mm-hmm. as men. And they have said, and they've argued just constantly until their face is red, see, this word means authority, authority, authority. They do all these word studies. What I end up concluding in my work is, yep, you're right. Unfortunately, it still doesn't mean what you think it means. And here's the reason why, not because the word meaning is different, but because of how it's used.
Yeah. what is the word doing?
What's the word doing? And there's this great irony in Ephesians 5 when Paul's saying, hey, and by the way, the husband is head over the wife, like Christ is head. And you start to think, oh man, authority, you know, submission and all that, which is part of the context of the conversation. And then you realize he says, oh, and how is Christ the head? He gives himself up. So it's like, okay, even if you want to consider that word to be an authority figure, he redefines it by saying, oh, okay, you want to think of authority, well then serve.
So there, so in itself becomes a subversive speech act.
Yep. And that's what I argue in that, that's what I suggest in that section of my work and what nobody's having the conversation about. Not nobody, there are a few scholars, Michelle Lee Barnwall, I think is one of them, and Cynthia Long Westfall have brought up these issues in Ephesians 5. And what's important isn't just what the word means, it's how it's being used. And there's this big twist in Ephesians 5. And so anyone who wants to say, Paul believes that men should be the authoritative ones ruling over their house, the point is, okay, well then serve. So you want to rule? Then serve. That's the kind of head that Paul has in mind.
Yeah. Well, and then you think of the upper room, you know, with the
bingo,
you know,
the washing of the feet, the
On the becoming a servant,
or the servant.
Yeah.
Philippians 2 says the exact same thing. So this is where I think our obsession in biblical studies with word meanings and word studies have led to these really brutally limited conversations. And then you get complementarians and egalitarians. In other words, people who have different views about men and women's roles in marriage and in the church, arguing over word meaning, when it's like, if you just read the passage a little more carefully, you realize the word meaning is there, but it's being used ironically.
Right. So you mentioned in one of our recent episodes something about Romans 13, and I think it might be interesting to look at that from the speech act perspective.
Sure. Yeah. It's complicated on many fronts because, in fact, I just saw a paper at the theology conference that I was at that I didn't actually have a chance to go to, but that I was able to read the summary of. And this person was arguing that because there have been interpretations of Ephesians 13 that have come out and said, no, Paul isn't just saying that the authorities need to be obeyed. There's some speech act strategies that are more subtle. That means he's challenging the empire. So in other words, Romans 13 isn't Paul's acquiescing to the authorities and saying, see, we have to obey them. Paul's actually taking subtle jabs at them. And one of the most common interpretations is that when Paul says that the authorities are appointed by God, he's doing something unprecedented in the Roman world by saying the authorities aren't gods themselves or sons of gods. They're actually instituted by the one true God of Israel, which would not have gone over well with any Roman emperor.
So there's this super awkward moment in the text, right? Then where we might look at it and the words say, submit yourself to the governing authorities, and you read it and you say, oh, okay. And then it says, because they've been, you know, given this authority by God, right? Yeah. And so it's like, oh, okay. So I should do it, and I should do it because that's what God wants. But if this other reading of the speech act is accurate, it could almost be meaning the opposite.
This is the problem. And this is what you'll find if you follow any of the controversies of theology on Twitter or any social media, is you'll get these folks who will consistently say, you know, the biblical view is, or a faithful biblical reading is, or the plain text of the Bible says. It's so much more complicated than that. And I'm not saying that to suggest the Bible doesn't have clear meaning, but to say usually what people mean by that is my reading of the Bible says.
Which is back to the interpretive question that we talked about at the beginning of this series, right? That we're making interpretive decisions before we ever even open the text.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard some pretty interesting comments coming from both sides of the camps of this issue on women leadership in a church, who have claimed that the other side doesn't have a biblical view. And what that really means is that they don't think the other side's reading the Bible faithfully, but what they're not really discussing is they're actually disagreeing deeply on their hermeneutic.
Right.
And so it's not just that they're thinking, and sometimes, you know, people are importing in non-biblical information in interpreting the Bible in ways that are maybe unhelpful, but there are other times where it's not even just it's a matter of actually they're reading the same text mm-hmm. and they're coming to different conclusions, not because they're ignoring the text, but because they're coming at it from different angles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which so means, in Romans 13, that's an incredible example of it could go either way. And it just depends on what your commitments are hermeneutically.
I think what's so interesting to me about that is thinking about in scholarship, paying attention to paradigmatic assumptions is really important because if you're arguing yeah. from different paradigms, you can't get to the point of agreement without first recognizing that you don't have the same paradigmatic framework, right? Like
right, that I sounds like your dissertation.
Yeah, it does a bit, doesn't it? But it's like, you know, if I am coming from an interpretivist framework and somebody else is coming from a positivist framework, like my critiques of their work are not going to be taking seriously their work from its own perspective. Right.
Yep, yep.
And so I can critique their paradigm, but it doesn't mean that I've understood their work well enough to critique it yeah. within their paradigm. Yep. So anyway, the hermeneutical stuff gets super interesting.
Well, and it goes so much deeper than that. Like, it's not just that these are hermeneutical battles. They're social location and social context all matters in our interpretation as well. Mm-hmm. So someone might say, well, this hermeneutic is leading me to this conclusion.
Right.
Which could very well be true, but what there could also be underlying it is certain political and historical, you know, locations that are causing that person to be naturally inclined towards a certain reading or not.
Yeah.
You know, so here's the deal. If you're a person, let's just imagine this. If you're a person in the US who has political power, imagine that you're a president of the United States and you're reading that passage, you may have, because of your social location and because of your position of power, you may have a natural inclination towards reading that as saying that people need to submit to the authority.
This is not a hypothetical, right? Jeff no, Sessions it's, did exactly that.
Yes. Yes. And used it in that way.
And probably, yeah. and I'm sure it wasn't the first, right? Like this is a very real question.
Well, and then it can go the other way. And some people will critique it by saying, well, you see, you're bringing up that example, but couldn't a person who has no political power misread the text because of their social location?
Of course.
So the question is really about how are our social locations and historical contexts and identities impacting our preconceived ideas of what to expect
yeah.
When we come to the scriptures, and to what extent might we allow the scriptures to challenge some of our assumptions?
Which is a question for every reader of scripture.
It is, yeah. So this is getting thick in the weeds, but it's related to questions of what the scriptures are saying and what they're doing with what they say, and then how we detect what they're doing, what they say, based on our hermeneutical methods and based on our social locations. And so I think a really legitimate critique is that many interpretations have emerged from a predominantly white Western male perspective in biblical studies that have hermeneutical limitations that have caused certain other readings of the scripture to be either devalued or simply not even invoked. Mm-hmm. I wish in my own work I would have had to just admit it. I think briefly, but admitted more of the fact that I can't remove myself from my own historical assumptions. And I have inherited a lot of that tradition of white Western male right. biblical studies, and I am a white Western male myself.
And
that doesn't mean that we're incapable of discerning meaning, but it means it should probably be helpful to acknowledge
right.
we're reading from that vantage point. Mm. And that might give me a certain proclivity towards some interpretations and others or away from others.
Yeah. This brings the second part of our second series on Justin's dissertation to a close. Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee. Reed Peters is a recognized patron of the show. As always, you can join us at patreon.com/profsinrooms for more conversation and bonus content. We hope you can join us for coffee again next time.